ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. The Territory Government has released a draft water allocation plan for the Mataranka region. Now, how much water will be made available for industry? And what has been done to protect the Mataranka Hot Springs and the Roper River? You will find out soon. You'll also today get to meet one of the nominees for this year's NT Rural Women's Award. A big show today. Let's get into it. We're broadcasting across the territory on the ABC. Now, the world's largest producer of Indian sandalwood has called in receivers, throwing into doubt thousands of hectares of plantations across the north, including about 3,500 hectares right here in the Northern Territory. FTI Consulting has been appointed as the receivers and has taken over operations of Quintus and its various subsidiaries. In a statement from FTI, it said that it's urgently calling for expressions of interest for a sale of this company or to recapitalise it. Quintus, formerly known as TFS, it planted its first sandalwood in the Ord Irrigation Scheme back in the 1990s. Rob Boschemmer, he has seen this industry grow over that time and even leased 700 hectares of his own country in the Ord to Quintus. And he says the news of it going into receivership did not come as a surprise.
Oh, it had to happen. When a company has got such high head office costs, it's really a small, medium farming business. And from what I could see, they had 70% head office costs. You'd want to keep office costs down around 10% to be successful. So no other farming enterprise I've ever seen could handle those overheads.
Where are you getting that figure from, that 70% office costs kind of? I know it's a rough figure, but where are you pulling that from?
Just looking at the reports on Quintus from previously before they became taken over by BlackRock. They even changed their management structures, and before that they were a listed public company.
You've been dealing with them a lot when it comes to the winding up of the MIS scheme, sandalwood in the Ord Valley. What's your experience been like when you've been dealing with that side of things over the past few months?
They've been rude, inconsiderate, haven't paid their bills, haven't talked to anyone, haven't looked at any other opportunities or any other ways of managing their system, and they've been very arrogant.
And so what would you like to see happen from here, knowing that those MIS schemes are still in the process of being wound up, and now on top of that, Quintus Australia has gone into receivership?
I give this an opportunity because now, as lessors, we've taken over the land. We can now deal directly with MIS growers and high net worth growers who've been disenfranchised by Quintus through this action. And if they want to keep investing in their trees, we're starting. They have the opportunity of getting a return on their investment.
So now you, as a landholder in the Ord Valley who was previously leasing that 700 hectares to Quintus Leasing for them to run that MIS scheme, now they've handed it back to you. Now that Quintus Leasing is in administration, they've handed that 700 hectares of sandalwood back to you to manage yourself.
Yes, well, we've taken it back. They didn't pay their bills, so we closed up on the lease.
How do you feel about that responsibility of having 700 hectares of sandalwood now, knowing that one of Quintus's main reasons for all of this turmoil over the past sort of 12 to 18 months has been a massive drop in the price of the sandalwood, heartwood and the oil? I think Richard Henfrey, the CEO of Quintus, said it had dropped by about 50% in the past few years. How do you feel about that?
Well, they had a flawed model. And that's what caused the drop. Firstly, they had to harvest all of this stuff at 15 years. Secondly, they went in there quite arrogantly and said, we're the big players in the market. We're going to tell all of you people out there in the sandalwood world what you're going to do. The fact is there's been families, businesses for 10 or more generations trading and working in sandalwood around the world. We believe that we can grow it effectively, really quite cheaply and even very cheaply because we've now got plantations that are nil value that are 15 years old, 10 to 15 years old. So we believe we can grow it and have the best price sandalwood in the world, good quality. We can keep it growing. We don't have to harvest it at 15 years. So, you know, we believe it should be grown out to 20 years, maybe even 25 years. So that's what we're aiming at doing. We have to get investors on board who will keep it going, but Qantas did have a good team on the ground, and same with Santinol. They got a lot of experience and they're doing a good job. So we'll pick the eyes out of the players there who want to keep working in the industry. As long as we can get the investors on board, we'll keep the sandalwood going, and it'll be a good viable business for Northern Australia. And Northern Australia is sort of light years ahead of anywhere else in the world in managing sandalwood plantations.
And so that's your plan for the what was previously MIS sandalwood plantations. What about all the sandalwood plantations right across Northern Australia that are owned by Qantas Australia that now FTI Consulting, who have been appointed receivers of Qantas, have said that they're looking to either sell or recapitalise? How do you feel about the idea of it going up for sale when it could potentially just be bought by someone who wants to rip those plantations down and plant cotton or some other crop that they think will make more money?
Well, I think the younger stuff, it's a wise idea to do that. Also, because Qantas have been in trouble for the last 12, 18 months. They haven't managed their sandalwood very well, and particularly the stuff on lighter soil in the Northern Territory. If it's not managed, the termites go through it. If you don't manage the water, the irrigation system, and pressurise the irrigation system very well. So a lot of those plantations are suffering anyway. I'm actually not sure how many of them are owned by Qantas. A lot of them are owned by their investors. So the investors had owned the land and the trees. And a number of those investors have actually replaced Qantas, or Qantas Forestry, as the manager of the trees, for good reason.
Qantas admitted that they felt as if they potentially inflated their own market by putting too much heartwood into the market at one time or over a short period of time. Do you think this is a good opportunity to work to solve that problem if a whole heap of sandalwood does end up getting bulldozed and it ends up with, less on the market?
Absolutely. I think there's a couple of years now where the market will be full of sandalwood. But, I would suspect that in four years' time or so that the market will be back to what it was and what it could be. So I think it's a golden opportunity for investors and for the sandalwood. And we'll make a decent industry of it.
Would you like to see Qantas recapitalised?
Oh, there's no point, really. What assets have they got? I don't believe they own many trees. Most of those are investor-owned trees, and so there's some question on whether they're Qantas's or not. I don't know how much land they've got, and their management team. Why would you employ a management team who manages to send a company broke?
That is Rob Boschammer, who's a farmer in the Ord Irrigation Scheme, speaking to Alice Marshall. If you're tuning in, this is the Country Hour, and we are talking about Qantas, which has gone into receivership. This is the world's largest Indian sandalwood company, and it has fallen over. Qantas has got plantations right across Northern Australia, including around Katherine and around the Douglas Daly region of the NT. Frank Miller is the chair of the Forestry Industry Association of the Northern Territory. Frank, this news about Qantas, what does it mean for the sandalwood plantations here in the Northern Territory?
Well, it's certainly unfortunate news, particularly for the workers at Qantas and their families. These are situations where administration processes are put in place do offer a lot of uncertainty for the external and internal parties. So I guess time will tell, Matt, but one thing that we do know is that there's a lot of resource, that a lot of money and design and maintenance has occurred over the years. And I think to certain parties looking to either take over that resource or look at the underlying land, we'll certainly have to take into consideration the value of that resource. So, yeah, I think we'll just time's going to tell whether it will be an overarching takeover of the resource, or whether it's going to be completely broken up and land use changes will occur, or whether individuals might want to manage those trees and realise the value of that down the track. So, yeah, time's going to tell.
We're talking about 3,500 hectares of sandalwood plantations around the Katherine region and the Douglas Daly region. The plantations in good health. We just heard there from Rob Boschhammer, who sort of alluded to the idea that perhaps they're not doing so well.
Well, I think that there's a number of different ownership models for the Northern Territory resource, and that's a range of what we refer to as mum and dad investors and smaller lot managed investment schemes right through to institutional owners, and I guess the mandate for management of those assets do vary a bit, and obviously the soil types and the water resources vary a little bit too. So yes, there is going to be a little bit of variation. I think that I'm not completely aware of poor quality plantations, but it may be suitable that some are rationalised and converted to different land uses.
You mentioned the employees of Quintus. Have you got a sense on how many people, how many families are affected by this announcement today?
Yeah, well, there's 30 full-time employees directly employed by Quintus in the Northern Territory. In addition to that, there's another 70-odd indirect service providers to the resource in the Northern Territory, and that's not insignificant in a Northern Territory sense. And having gone through this process personally in another career that I had, my thoughts are going out to the employees and their families. It's certainly a time of uncertainty. That uncertainty does sort of lead in some senses to paranoia, and we really hope that some stability can come through, whether it be on the existing trees or through other opportunities on the underlying land for those people, because they carry a lot of knowledge about not only the trees, but certainly the properties themselves.
I see FTI Consulting, which has been appointed as the receivers, it's talking about urgently calling for expressions of interest for a sale of the company or to recapitalise it. With your, I guess, background history in this type of thing, Frank Miller, is this something that can be sorted out quickly, or is it something that does take months and longer?
It's an absolute legal and I guess in a business minefield, particularly when you've got such a wide variation of asset ownership. You've got, as I said before, you've got institutional owners, you've got mum and dad investors, and then you've got the overlying management company. So there's a lot to tease out. I really hope that FTI manage this well and respect the fact that it's an irrigated crop. There's certain, essential expenditure that needs to occur in a period of receivership, and I hope that they can see the need to maintain the trees. Otherwise, there is risk that the resource will go into demise if those delays are dragged out. So in some instances, some of those processes can take, well over 12 months, 24 months, 36 months. But I would hope to think that there's enough interest in this bespoke type of resource and there's enough institutional participation in this, in growing sandalwood and managing and selling sandalwood, that there may be some candidates that are ready to make this a simple process. So it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds in the coming weeks, Matt.
The Northern Territory is home to large plantations of mahogany, large plantations of acacia mangium trees. Do you think Indian sandalwood has a future in the NT?
Well, I think that there's a suitable climate, there's water resources, there's the know-how, I think the big missing piece is supply chains. This process of receivership and, as I mentioned before, rationalisation of the resource may benefit the overall value of the assets in time. And I think that with the support and the maturing of the mahogany resources and the resource and the Tiwi Island project, we're going to see a development of supply chains that will might make the sandalwood more attractive. So, as I say, I've seen forestry companies go belly up and forest resources are still highly valued and required in the marketplace, both domestically and internationally. So I really hope that there is a future for sandalwood. But, yeah, what that looks like, Matt, we'll wait and see.
Thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thanks, Matt.
Appreciate it. That's Frank Miller, who's the chair of the Forestry Industry Association of the Northern Territory, Quintus, which runs sandalwood plantations around Katherine and the Douglas Daly, the oil irrigation scheme, also a bit over in the Burdekin region of Queensland. It has gone into receivership. You can read more about this right now if you head along to the NT Country Hour website.
Hey everyone, my name is Bernard England and I'm a sawmill worker in Manugura community. And you're listening to the Country Hour on ABC.
It is 13 to 1. The stats do not lie. The stats don't lie. They show that Aussies are consuming more and more chicken. So why are chicken farmers in this nation crying foul? The NFF has been investigating problems within the poultry sector and its report is out today. I'll be sharing it with you after this quick tune. Right across the territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. Matt Brown with you this afternoon. Just keeping you up to date on the Barkly Highway. A number of restrictions still in place. So the highway is open during daylight hours, but only for high clearance four-wheel drives. If you're over 4.5 tonnes, you are not allowed on the Barkly between the Threeways and the Barkly Homestead at the moment. And there are directional flow restrictions in place as well. So if you're heading eastbound on the Barkly, you are only allowed to do so between 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the morning. If you're heading westbound, you can only do that between midday and 3 o'clock this afternoon. And just repeating, a maximum of 4.5 tonnes on that Barkly Highway. There's been some damage because of flooding. I keep promising you an interview with the Department of Infrastructure about this, and it keeps getting postponed. My apologies. Hopefully tomorrow.
You've waited so patiently.
Where is Bluey?
But on Sunday the 14th of April...
I definitely heard something.
It's only the biggest ever episode of Bluey.
Ta-da!
But first, what? Just when you thought it was safe...
Pick up the granny!
No!
A brand new episode of Bluey this Sunday.
No! Bad granny!
Cheeky kids.
All new Bluey starts this Sunday, 8 a.m. on ABC iView.
Despite the cost of living crisis, chicken is still one of the most affordable meats on the shelves, and we're eating lots of it. But poultry farmers say their industry is in crisis because the industry is dominated by powerful processors. The National Farmers Federation has been investigating this issue over the last 18 months and has released its final report today. It says a mandatory code of conduct for this industry is the only way forward, as Mary Louise Vince reports.
Australians love their chicken meat. We all eat, on average, about 50 kilos a year. And according to the latest agricultural data, our consumption is on the rise, doubling over the past 3 decades. As the cost of living continues, chicken is attractive for consumers because it's the most affordable meat around. But farmers say they're going backwards because of what they describe as unscrupulous behaviour by powerful processors in one of the nation's most highly concentrated markets. Dr. Joanne Sillins from the Australian Chicken Growers Council says farmers have had enough.
There's 180 million chickens go into consumers' mouths every year, which is now outstripping most of the red meats. But of that $14 a kilo that you're paying for your breast meat or your thigh meat, the grower gets around a dollar.
While the two big supermarkets control 65% of the grocery market, Australia's chicken meat industry is dominated by two main players, Ingham's and Baiada Poultry, which control 70%. Some of their well-known brands include Steggles and Lilydale.
You're trapped by a contract that is unconscionable, inequitable, and puts all the risks onto yourself. So it's getting harder and harder and harder to be a chicken farmer nowadays.
Gary Eckert was a chicken grower in the New South Wales Hunter Valley for two decades before being forced out of the industry.
What the growers are on now is probably considerably less than what we were on when we got out 14 years ago. You know, they've got the power to do what they want and try and dictate price and screw the growers down.
Mr. Eckert knows all too well the power wielded by the processors. He was one of several growers who took lengthy legal action over a contract dispute. The farmers won, but those heavily involved, including Mr. Eckert, appeared to pay the ultimate price.
But at the end of that 10-year contract, those three growers that were involved in that case more so were told that their farms were surplus to the processors' needs.
Most chicken farmers are too afraid to speak publicly about their experiences for fear of reprisals, but Dr. Sillin says she's hearing similar stories from growers across the country. Several have spoken to the ABC on the condition of anonymity. These are not their real voices.
Chicken farming has always been a struggle. Growers need processors, but we need to be remunerated to make the growing side of things more viable.
One farmer who's in the process of exiting the industry likens it to being involved in a dictatorship.
Apart from the financial burden, it's emotionally and psychologically unhealthy. They dictate and control your life. You're at their mercy.
Another grower says low returns are hitting hard.
The poor returns for chicken farming are stifling investment. The power of the big two is a constant threat over our head.
In 2022, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission said the companies held too much power and the contracts could cause significant financial harm to growers. The processors were asked to make some of their contracts with farmers fairer, but the Growers' Council argues little has changed. The National Farmers Federation says a mandatory code of conduct is the only tool the government can adopt to address poultry meat supply chain issues. Its final report, released today, identifies a widespread lack of market transparency, misuse of market power, and economic harm. A proposed code is also included in the report, which the Federation says would provide a regulatory framework to ensure confidence and fair trading for all participants in the poultry meat supply chain. In a statement, the Federal Minister for Agriculture, Murray Watt, wouldn't commit to a mandatory code, but says the final report will be carefully considered by the government. In their submission to the NFF, the body representing the processors, the Australian Poultry Meat Association, says it doesn't see any need for a code of conduct. In a statement to the ABC, the association says the long-term viability of the industry is of national significance and all stakeholders continue to work together to ensure it continues to grow. It maintains no party in the supply chain can control the production and supply of chicken meat to the detriment of others, saying the industry would not be sustainable. Meanwhile, more than 25 poultry farms are currently up for sale online. Joanne Sillins says she fears for the industry's future unless there's action.
We've got ageing farmers. We've lost the next generation of would-be farmers, and they would have been good ones. And we're seeing farms sell up, break down, break up, lie empty.
The ABC has also contacted Ingham's and Baiada for comment.
Mary Louise Vince with that report. Now, on the Country Hour yesterday, we heard about plans to unleash ladybugs right across Darwin in an effort to control an exotic mealybug that is making frangipani trees very sick.
We're going to do an experiment. Now it's getting drier, probably after Easter. We found that one of the local ladybirds called Cryptolemus, common name is mealybug ladybird. They actually love these things, and they've been effective overseas, and they're effective in Darwin. We've had trees that have been cleared by these things, and they're things that you can buy from biological supply houses, from Bugs for Bugs and places like that. So after Easter, when it's a bit drier, we're going to get some of those and release them to up the population of those while the parasitoid is getting underway.
Release the ladybugs. That was Dr. Brian Thistleton on the Country Hour yesterday. One person who is hoping the ladybugs work is former NT Ag Minister and now Lord Mayor of Darwin, Con Vatskalis. He says the Darwin City Council has been seeing a lot of Darwin's beautiful frangipani trees getting attacked by this pest.
Absolutely. They've been hammered. They've been hammered to such a degree that the only solution we've got at this stage is to actually cut them so they will not pass the infection to other trees next to them. And I'm really worried because we've got beautiful frangipanis, especially down in the Gardens Road, that they've got different colors and different species of frangipani. I don't want to lose those ones. I don't want to lose any trees. Unfortunately, we live in an environment, a tropical environment, and the other thing you have to remember, we're very close to Timor and Indonesia, and that's where we're really worried now. And I was always worried about biohazards coming from there. The millibugs, they completely destroy the hibiscus in my house. The last one, I'm watching it now, and I think it's time for it to go. It's so sad. Doesn't matter what I do. I try to control the ants. I can't do it. I try to spray oil. Nothing happens. And I don't want to use chemicals. Hopefully, what I hear today in ABC with the chief pathologist or plant pathologist getting the ladybugs here, that might be effective. But I think my hibiscus had it.
Former Ag Minister and Lord Mayor Con Vatskalis. He's hoping the ladybugs do the trick. I've got a text here on 0487991057. Jeff says, Matt, with this outbreak of the mealybug and how quick it's getting around, makes me think about our slack quarantine at our entry points, is what Jeff's thinking about this afternoon. I went for a bit of a walk around my neighbourhood yesterday afternoon and paid close attention to frangipani trees. Wow. Wow. They are looking sick, aren't they? They are not looking well at all. We've got to go to the newsroom. See you back here in five.
Hi there, Stuart Weir from Emery Station. We've got a really good season, good cattle prices. Hopefully everything's going to tick along and you're listening to the Northern Territory Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. If you've just tuned in, you've missed a lot, including our coverage of Indian sandalwood company Quintus going into receivership. Those stories will be up on our podcast later on this afternoon. In a moment, another very important story. We'll be taking a look at the draft water allocation plan for the Mataranka region. The NT government has released this plan. It's been years in the making. Now it's out for public comment. Let's take a look at it in a moment here on the Country Hour. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter is there this afternoon. Sally, that south-easterly surge, where is it?
Well, we started to see the dew points drop in Tennant Creek, so the drier air's got up that far. So the wind's probably a little bit ahead of it. We are still seeing a little bit of cloud that's probably got some showers in it just through the southern parts of the Barkly, but that's sort of expected. That should clear off today, and we are seeing a few showers up around the Gregory district at the moment. And then we're starting to see the convection bubble away over the top end as well. So we're seeing just those little bubbles, but the dry air coming up into that Tennant Creek area will just allow people to feel... We'll feel less humidity, that's probably the first thing, but it also is going to probably help with that evaporation a little bit of the water on the ground, because you're going to allow the sun in, and also the air can just hold that little bit more moisture, so it's got something to evaporate into.
The Victoria River District just keeps on jagging a little bit of rain. Saddle Creek's had 14 millimetres to 9 o'clock this morning. Bullow River Cattle Station 14, Dashwood Crossing 20, Keeper River National Parks had 13, Border Creek 26, Old Delamere 16. Can the VRD expect a bit more of that in the next 24 hours?
It's easing off. So as that surge moves northwards, the precipitation and showers are going to get fewer and further between. We're still going to see them around potentially, but they're just going to become very isolated. So the chance of them actually getting into a rain gauge will decrease, but also that means it will decrease the chance of sort of any given spot getting it.
When this surge reaches the top end, what's it going to feel like, say, if you're a farmer in Darwin's rural area?
It'll be a little bit drier. Unfortunately, it's going to get a little bit hotter because we do have a little bit of easterly component to it, and that's going to just bring that hot air from inland over to the Arnhem District, where we are sort of looking at temperatures, forecast temperatures in the high 30s, 35 to 37-ish, and then we're looking at 35s on the coast just because the stronger winds keep the sea breezes out. So it's just going to get that little bit hotter, unfortunately, but it's going to feel dry. It's going to be drier, just a little bit drier, so it's not going to feel quite as oppressive. You still feel humid. And then there's a chance that we might see another little bit of a surge reinforcing it next week, which could bring things down a little bit more. But it's going to be a respite from those really high dew points that we have had for most of the wet season.
Looks like it's pouring down on the Tiwi Islands this afternoon. There's still some decent moisture around well to the north.
Oh, yeah, there's been storms all the way, showers and sort of up around the Tiwi Islands all night. We do have the trough offshore at the moment, so that's running through the Arafura Sea, and we are watching an area that's probably a bit in the Timor Sea at the moment, but in that sort of off the northwest Kimberley area for the development of a potential cyclone, but it's still sort of only a moderate chance. So we're keeping an eye on it. It's probably not going to impact the NT, but we just got with that trough over water, and the fact that it's a little bit active, we just got to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, okay. A moderate chance. I'm just looking at the Bureau's tropical cyclone forecast page now, so I guess a lot more will be known come sort of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week.
Yeah, next week's sort of the more interesting, in inverted commas, sort of period. At the moment, we're just sort of got this ridge coming in through for the territory, so that's going to quieten things down a bit.
Anything else we need to be aware of in terms of the next couple of days?
Not really. Just be aware that the winds are picking up over the coastal waters as this trough approaches. So we could see up to 25 knots in the Gulf Carpentaria. At the moment, it looks marginal for strong wind mornings, but check the forecast before you head out just in case we do see the winds have. We'll expect the winds to be up over that threshold, but they're probably over the 15-knot threshold anyway for small craft.
Yeah. All right, then. Thanks so much for your time, Sally.
That's okay.
It is 10 past one, and you are tuned into the Country Hour. The draft water allocation plan for the Mataranka region has been unveiled. You'll learn all about it next.
Time for the family road trip.
98.
The big prawn.
Ah, yes.
99.
The big mosquito.
It's a real one.
Is it? And 100.
Easy.
The big listen app.
Of course.
The ABC Listen app has a big array of road trip ready podcasts, radio, audiobooks, music and sport. Something for everyone.
I guess it has to be big to fit in all those podcasts.
Aww. For a big selection of audio entertainment.
Really, Dad?
Listen big. Download the free ABC Listen app today.
The NT government has released its long-awaited draft water allocation plan for the Mataranka region. This plan is comprised of three water management zones. There's the North Mataranka, South Mataranka and Larrimah. And the estimated sustainable yield for those three areas is a maximum of around 62,000 megalitres every single year. Now, the public consultation period is now open. To learn more about this plan, I had a chat to Amy Dysart, who is the Executive Director of NT Water Resources.
It's good to have this plan out. It's been under development for a number of years. It is looking to manage the groundwater resources in the Mataranka plan area. The plan separates the resources into three management zones, and those management zones reflect the flow of groundwater and where it flows into the Roper River in some places, and those where the connection to the Roper is much slower.
So it's split into three management areas. There's now, what, North Matarenka, South Matarenka and Larrimah?
Yes. And they represent different conditions in both those areas. So we've had to take different approaches for those different types of resources there. So in North and South Matarenka, those are top-end resources. So there are fill-and-spill types of resources that drain out into the river during the dry season and keep the dry season flows. In the Larrimah zone, it's not as connected to the river, so the water is much deeper and moves much more slowly. So those are what we call our arid zone resources. So they're more based on the storage volume that's underneath the ground.
Across these three areas, the water allocation plan says there's an estimated sustainable yield of about 62,000 megalitres every year. How much of that water is already getting used by industries?
Yeah, so in that north area where we've got these fill and spill aquifers in North Matarenka and South Matarenka, the plan caps the development at those levels that has currently been licensed today. So no more water is available to be licensed in that area.
Right. So if Matt the farmer wanted to get a groundwater license tomorrow near Matarenka, I couldn't.
No. And the reason that we've done that is that that area around Elsey National Park has been identified as having outstanding environmental values. So in order to protect that area, along with Rainbow and Bitter Springs, which are well-known iconic springs in that area, we want to be cautious about the level of development. We've said we're not seeing any adverse effects now, so let's leave development where it is at the moment. And instead, further south, closer to Larrimah, where there's less environmental impacts and less connection to those iconic environmental assets, we release more water for development in the area. So there can be still development. It's just a little bit further south to ensure that we balance that with not having as much environmental impact from that development.
Right. And the estimated sustainable yield for that Larrimah area is around 35,000 megalitres each year. Do you know how much water of that's already been used?
Off the top of my head, I think it's about 8,000 megalitres is currently licensed at the moment. So there will be more water available for licensing in the Larrimah area.
Back in 2021, a 10,000 megalitre water licence for the Larrimah region got revoked. You and I would have spoken about that at the time, I'm sure. And yes. I've got a quote here from the time from the Northern Land Council, which said that allocation was not based on the best available scientific information and that it would be unsustainable in the long term, creating risks to all Territorians. So if 10,000 megalitres was seen as a risk, what's 35,000 megalitres represent?
Well, I think, the science in that area, there's a couple of things that have changed since then. One, there's been further science done in terms of the strategic environmental baseline assessment that's been conducted in that area and all the way through to the Beetaloo area. So we understand the level of connection and conductivity very well. Also, the department has since released a paper which is a technical paper back in 2021 that explains the difference between what we talked about before with the top-end fill and spill-like aquifers and then what we call those arid zone aquifers, those ones which are not connected or discharging out into the environment. And in this area, we have both of those, and this is where the transition occurs. So Larrimah is an arid zone resource. It has been characterised like that way, and that way it has been allocated from the amount of water in storage. So those are the things that have changed since the Land Council, provided that quote a number of years ago.
Within moments of this draft plan being released on Thursday, there were some environment groups who straight away were on the attack, condemning the plan and saying, and this is a quote, it would be the death knell for the Matarenka hot springs. What would you say to that criticism, Amy Dysart?
I would say that is absolutely misleading and not true. And the reason for that is exactly what we talked about before you posed that question. which is that this plan actually limits the amount of water that's available in that northern and south Matarenka area, which is, connected to the both the springs and the Roper River to ensure its protection. So any suggestion that this makes more water available is completely untrue.
And what about drawing water from underneath Larimer? Could that have an impact on the Roper and the hot springs?
What we know about the water down in Larimer is that it moves very slowly, and it will take a number of years for it to travel through to the Roper, like hundreds of thousands of years. Unlike to the Roper River, where we know it's highly connected and happens in a short time frame, and that's why we've not allowed more development in that area closer to the river. However, in Larimer, that level of conductivity is beyond the timeframes in which we're planning for. You know, we plan for sort of 10, 20, 50, 100 years, you know, a number of generations, and we're talking timeframes long beyond that. So therefore, it's quite appropriate for the utilisation of those resources during the period of this 10-year plan.
If you're tuning in, this is the Country Hour, and we're speaking to Amy Dysart, who is the Executive Director of NT Water Resources. The government has released its draft water allocation plan for the Matarenka region. You have got until the 3rd of June to have your say. Amy, is there anything else that you'd like to tell our audience about this plan?
The only other thing was just that you know, this particular catchment has a high level of climate variability. And therefore, when we've set those, those protections and requirements, particularly in the North and South Matarenka, it means that there's actually going to be three different flow thresholds depending on the climatic conditions we're in. So at the moment, we're in a wet period. So there's a certain threshold that needs to be met when we do our, you know, annual assessment of the resource to identify if any seasonal adjustments need to be made through announced allocations. So there'll be one for when we're in wet climate, in a average climate, and in a dry climate. So we do expect that this, resource is more variable than some of the other resources in the territory, and it is likely that announced allocations will be implemented more often in this resource because of that natural climate variability.
Right. So if there's a poor wet season, water allocations to farmers could be reduced.
Yes. And we do know that it's likely to happen more frequently in this area. Not by much, but we do know it is more variable, so therefore more likely.
Thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
No problem.
That's Amy Dysart, who's the Executive Director of NT Water Resources. Des Barrett runs the Little Roper Stock Camp and says he's seen a lot of pressure being put on the Roper River and says he's not confident in the government's scientific work that underpins this new water allocation plan. He says the hot springs near Matarenka need to be protected at all costs.
If anything happens particularly to the hot springs, then no one's going to stop. Like, no one's going to stop here if they can't have a swim in the hot springs, as was evident by Easter when I didn't really have anyone. I've got no one booked in today. By now I should have probably 12 vans. People stop here to have a swim. And these two springs, they are iconic. You know, you look at the amount of tourism brochures that have either thermal pools or bitter springs, or every single Northern Territory major tourist brochure has one of those springs on it. Like, these places are iconic. They're like, we get more visitation here than Catherine Gorge. They're iconic. They're territory legends. And if there's a threat in any way to them, it's bloody criminal, you know. It is really complicated, and I don't say that I'm the expert at any of it, but I do know that we need proper experts, and the NT government, to them it's all political. They just get and they do the spin, and they speak really well, you know. like that. I think you're the lady on the country hour today. To me, frankly, you know, next time anyone said that, I'd shout them down because that's not science. I want science. I want science and I want more research.
That's Des Barrett, who runs the Little Roper Stock Camp near Mataranka. He's got some concerns about this new draft water allocation plan. The public consultation period is now open. You can have your say on it. You've got until the 3rd of June. Just log on to the Have Your Say website on the NT government. Text message here, no name attached to it though. The message says, huge water has been given away out of our system. The lady there just interviewed says the water moves slowly. So does that mean it doesn't matter if it dries up in 600 years? Also, their models are dodgy, according to this person who has put no name to the text. 0487991057. A story I'm sure we'll be talking more about in the coming weeks. Now, the winner of the 2024 NT Rural Women's Award will be announced tonight in Darwin. There are four wonderful nominees this year for this award, and the Country Hour is catching up with all of the nominees this week and featuring their stories, featuring their projects. Yesterday you heard from Raylene Brown from Kungas Can Cook. Our next nominee is Tanya Edgington. Now, Tanya was nominated for her remote op shop project, which supplies recycled clothes to remote communities while also creating some work opportunities. She explains why she signed up to be a part of this award.
I recognise that in the Territory, that compared to maybe other states and urban areas, that the work that we're doing here and the incredible work by a lot of people here often goes unseen and unheard by the rest of Australia. So I really wanted to sign up to the award and look for an opportunity there to be able to tell the stories on a, you know, on a national platform to the rest of Australia. And I think, you know, the aim of the award is to celebrate leadership, but it's more than that. It's about how do we elevate women in leadership and elevate the projects they're doing and you know, move those to another level.
And Tanya, your project is called the Remote Op Shop Project. Tell us about that.
The Remote Op Shop Project started in 2016, and I was living and working in Katherine as doing Indigenous business development. And some women in Jiltmingan called, and they were being basically forced to participate in a Work for the Dole program there, where they were turning up for 25 hours a week and having their names ticked off, but they were given nothing to do. So they're literally sitting in an empty shed for 25 hours a week. And these women, you know, stepped up and showed courage. They gave us a call and they said, you know, we want to start our own art centre. We're creative women. We don't want to waste our talents and gifts. We don't want to sit here all day, but we want to self-fund it. So what can we do to fund this art centre? And so we sat down with them and started mapping out all the opportunities to fund the art centre, and one of them was an op shop. And so we got busy, we put a call out on Facebook for a couple of boxes of clothing, and what happened next was that post went viral. So we ended up with people all over Australia wanting to donate clothing. We had 35 drop-off locations across the country. Hundreds of volunteers came together to sort and pack boxes. And within a few weeks, we ended up with 700 boxes of clothing coming up on two trucks to Katherine. So the women were absolutely amazed by the response. They just couldn't believe that people all over Australia wanted to support them. And from there, they were able to set up their op shop. They sold around $10,000 worth of clothing and household goods in the first 3 months. They incorporated their art centre and bought all their own art supplies. And for me, you know, that was a real demonstration of self-determination in action. So I saw the potential. We were able to get a lot of other communities up and running with all that excess stock. And over the last 8 years, that's just continued to grow and grow and grow. So we have 30,000 donors online now that send goods directly to the op shop network. We have around 20 active remote communities that are receiving goods. And, you know, really every other week I'm getting a call from a woman in a community saying, like, I want to do this for my community. So it's time to scale up this project.
And if you win the award, what will you do with the grant money?
Well, it's a good question. We're currently looking to scale up the remote op shop project. So The fashion industry is currently responsible for about 200,000 tonnes of textiles going to landfill each year. So we're engaging them as part of the solution. We're asking them to support through the donation of goods and developing up a reuse and recycling hub to capture that excess and have that redistributed back out to remote communities. Now, as part of that, we really want to tighten up our governance. So we'll be creating a First Nations Leadership Council, and that will be made up of women from the communities who will help guide the governance structure, the impact model, and keep us informed about what the needs are on the ground. So that money will be used, along with additional funding that I will be contributing, to bring those women together and start to form that leadership council.
That is Tanya Edginton, one of the nominees for the 2024 AgriFutures NT Rural Women's Award, which will be announced tonight. She was speaking to Jan Kahoot. Now, our top story today on the Country Hour was that sandalwood company Quintus has gone into receivership. We spoke earlier on to Frank Miller from the Forestry Industry Association of the NT. He says it is not good news and his thoughts are with Quintus employees.
Well, it's certainly unfortunate news, particularly for the workers at Quintus and their families. These are situations where administration processes are put in place do offer a lot of uncertainty for the external and internal parties. So, yeah, I think we'll just time's going to tell whether it will be an overarching takeover of the resource or whether it's going to be completely broken up and, land use changes will occur, or whether individuals might want to manage those trees and realise the value of that down the track. So, yeah, time's going to tell.
That is Frank Miller speaking to us earlier on. If you missed our coverage about Quintus going into receivership, that'll be up on our podcast later on this afternoon. No Dublin Mark report today because of the Easter period. There were two cattle ships that left Darwin Port on the weekend bound for Indonesia. The Brahman Express was anchored off Darwin a short time ago. And, of course, everyone waiting to see the test results from those cattle that died on the ship and in the export yards. Hopefully have news on that for you soon. Keep it rural.